Okay, questions? Do we have any questions before we get started? No questions? Okay. So we are going to continue the discussion of clustering. I basically mentioned k-means clustering towards the end of last class. It's a pretty straightforward and very well-known algorithm. And basically, what we are doing there is, if you know the number of clusters you're going to find, then you pick some centroids for each of the clusters. Okay, the centroids could be the existing points, or you can make any random points up. Okay, normally you just pick k points from the existing points, and then call them the centroids, and then essentially you go through a loop where every point then finds its distance to one of, each of the centroids, and decides to become part of the cluster that it is closest to. The part of the cluster represented by the centroid that it's closest to. And then after everybody does that, then you can recompute the actual centroid of each of these clusters and then repeat this. And you can do this until there is no more change between iterations, at which point you would say that k-means has converged. Okay? Now, what k-means is trying to do is, you could think of that in terms of just the cluster tightness. Okay? So the idea is, if you compute for each cluster, for the kth cluster, you compute the distance between each of the points in the cluster and the centroid of the cluster, and you square them up for all the points and add them up, that's the squared distance of all the points in that cluster. Okay? And it will be the smallest if the cluster is really tight. That means everybody is very close to their centroid. Okay? And if you add them for all the k clusters, that would essentially be giving you the total cluster tightness. And you can essentially see that as you go through this loop, iteration to iteration, you are reducing this sum. Okay? And at some point of time, you have reached a local minimum, and you won't change anymore. You would not reduce the overall dissimilarity anymore. Okay? So we looked at examples. So basically, here is an example that we looked at as to what happens when you actually go through this from iteration to iteration. And then here is another example where there is some more data here, and by picking clusters, centroids as here and here, as you go through the number of iterations, you basically start seeing that the centroids move, even if you actually start with the centroid both in the same cluster to begin with. Okay? That's the sort of same thing that we did earlier here, where let's see, where in the beginning we actually took two centroids in the same cluster, which we did not know is the same cluster, but in the beginning we won't know. But more or less, the point of this is that the centroids are moving to keep up with the actual cluster configuration. Okay. So what we'll do in the next several minutes is to look at, this is a very simple algorithm, but it can be extended in many different ways. Just the k-means itself can be extended in many different ways. And then we'll look at its limitations and the ways of extending it. Okay? That in itself is like a cottage industry of k-means algorithm that's been out there. Okay. So of course, the very first problem with k-means is you need to know the k in advance, okay, which is the number of clusters should be known in advance. And as I mentioned last time, there are situations where you might know how many clusters are supposed to be there. There are also situations where you have no clue. And the problem with k-means is it's never going to not find k clusters. If you say find seven clusters, it will find seven clusters. So in fact, if for this particular example, if you say find seven clusters, it will still find seven clusters. You understand what I'm saying? So the real issue, of course, is if you see this data, you'd say, well, it really should be two clusters. Okay, but how would you know? And towards the end of last class, I was suggesting that, well, one idea would be to increase the, you know, find two clusters, clustering, okay, and see what this value is for the two cluster clustering. So that would be sum of the dissimilarity of two clusters at the end. Okay, and then you do three cluster clustering, and then you do four cluster clustering, and so on, until you find a point where this has reached minimum. The problem with that, of course, is that it will always reach a minimum when the number of clusters is equal to number of points. Okay, that will be zero at that point of time. So what you really need to do instead is to actually look at the rate of change of this dissimilarity, the R, you know, cluster tightness measure. Okay, and so that's what we were talking about last time. That so, for example, here is a scenario where we were looking at the residual sum of squares here, the cluster sum, cluster dissimilarity measure here, and the number of clusters here. And as you see, as you increase the number of clusters, it'll ultimately become zero. But what would be interesting is to see the rate at which the slope, so basically take the derivative in a sense of the way this is changing, and then look for the place where it is changing, you know, from higher rate to a lower rate. Okay, so in this particular case, for example, you would say that here is one knee point, and then sort of here is one knee point. Okay, so you could say either 4 or 8 clusters. Now, of course, this isn't exactly easy to do. This basically requires that you consider a large number of cluster sizes. Okay, and then for each clustering, the other thing that we will look at in a minute is that it's not even enough to find, you know, if I say k equal to 7, we'll see in a minute that if you just run k equal to 7 with some random number of, you know, random 7 seeds, you may not actually reach the lowest possible value you could have reached for k equal to 7. Because seeds wind up making, depending on the seeds that you pick, the k-means can actually converge to a local minimum, even for that particular k-value. Okay? So in general, really what you're talking about is for each k-value, you would run the k-means clustering, say, 10 times. Among all those times, find the best dissimilarity measure it ever reached. Okay, that would correspond to the maximum that you, at least empirically, you could reach for k equal to that value. And then do it for the next, and do it for the next, and so on. That's how you do this. Okay, obviously it's a much costlier way. So this is sort of interesting if in fact you're just trying to figure out what would have been the right number of clusters in this particular piece of data, because I'm trying to theorize about it. But you may not be able to do this, for example, in, you know, online search scenarios where after, you know, 100 or 200 results have been made, you're trying to figure out how many clusters should we split it into. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. But like we discussed in social networks, but if you cluster to the point that every point is one cluster, then you again get the original information content back.
Mm-hmm.
So the two situations where there's one cluster without a point, or there are n clusters with one point each,
is the same. Yeah, I agree. No, basically, because what is happening in this particular case is, if you notice, originally we said that the internal measure of goodness of a cluster should depend both on individual clusters' tightness and the distance between the clusters. Okay, in this measure, only one piece is being taken into account. We are only considering how tight are each of the clusters, but you're not taking into account how far away each of the clusters from each other. Okay, if you take that also into account, you would start seeing that, you know, beginning and ending are basically the same. It's not, no, I don't know that. First of all, you may not get to phase transition for everything, but, you know, there may be a point. So in essence, this is this picture that we showed, that knee point picture, is showing that at least for this example, there is some natural number of clusters. No, no, no. I mean, this is decreasing in the tense, in the sense of the one single measure. If you take the other one, then you can convert. So, for example, if you want to change from this into a, you know, a single function which is maximized or minimized, for example, in this particular case, you could have taken the derivative. Okay, but your point is more like this. So, penalizing the lots of clusters. Okay, so the idea is k-means is ignoring the number of clusters, you know, basically because the way we are looking at the effective measure of goodness of clusters is only in terms of how good each individual clusters are, how tight they are. Okay, you can have many tight clusters, but they are very small. Okay, so the total number of clusters is increasing. And you know that if you increase the number of clusters, there's a problem there too. Okay. So in a way, really, what this kind of clustering needs to do is solve an optimization problem, where, you know, for every possible value of k, you can consider the total benefit in terms of the tight clustering, the tightness of the clusters, minus a cost function, which is basically the number of clusters. As you increase the number of clusters, you are being penalized. Okay. But instead of solving this optimization problem, we are solving a simple greedy. I mean, we are doing a simple greedy search. Okay, so that's the price we are paying. We will look at in a minute a different idea called bisecting k-means, which does solve this problem in a minute in a different way. Okay, in terms of deciding how many clusters are there. Okay, so anyway, so this is a big problem, which is you know, the number, knowing k in advance. But we will talk about bisecting k-means. I'll write this here. Which essentially tries to incrementally figure out how many times to split. You know, basically what number of clusters should we find. Okay. Let me actually see if I should just explain that. Okay. Okay. We'll come back to the bisecting k-means. The other thing, of course, that, you know, I was mentioning to you earlier is that depending on the actual random seeds you pick, you may converge to different kinds of clusterings. Okay. So as an example, suppose I have the following A, B, C, D, E, F points. Okay. And if in this particular case, in this particular example, if I pick B and E as the centroids and I run k-means, then I would get ABC cluster and DEF cluster, assuming I'm only looking for two clusters. If on the other hand I took D and F as the centroids, and I'm going to get this as one cluster, this as another cluster. And once basically if I get this and this, I will no longer change anymore. Okay? And similarly, once I get this and this, I will no longer change anymore. So that means in both cases, k-means has converged to a point. You know, to the lowest point it can reach, okay, and it's not going to be able to change at that point of time. Okay, part of the reason, can somebody explain why that could happen? Can you think of why is it that, suppose it turns out based on the way I make this picture, one of these clusterings might actually be better than the other clustering, and you basically, that means the tightness, the cluster tightness measure, or the cluster dissimilarity measure would be lower for one and higher for the other. Okay. However, depending on the seeds that you're starting with, k-means is stuck in one place and it's refusing to move, even though there supposedly is a better point. Okay. So can you think of an intuitive reason as to why such a local minimum, why it just gets attracted to that local minimum? What do you need to do such that it will actually go and find the better case? Yes, it is hill climbing. Basically, we are doing greedy, you know, hill climbing kind of search. But so, what do you do in hill climbing to? Yes. Yes. Go ahead.
Greedy algorithm, right? You do not accept a k that's worse off than the one you're currently
So here's my point is different. I'm not asking the solution. I'm asking the following thing. What part of K means is, suppose if you got stuck with, I'm sorry, this cluster and this cluster. I'm not able to move from there to this and this. We do change clusters, right? In the normal way K-means goes, even when we started with both the centroids in the one of the clusters, they moved. They did move. So it's not like K-means just sticks wherever you keep it. However, it doesn't seem to want to move from here and here. I mean, so yeah, clustering like this and like this to like this and like this. How can you make sense of that? Yes. Yes, you can do that. That's fine. That's a solution. Okay. So the idea is anytime you get stuck in local minimum based on the random seeds you start with, you can try multiple random seeds and each time see where you get stuck at and then figure out whichever is the best place you get stuck at. That's the best one. What would be more interesting is to try and understand actually what part of the K-means algorithm is making it feel contented. What happens in these kinds of scenarios is that if you remember, the way K-means does is individual points are shifting their allegiance, one point at a time. Sometimes there is no single point that can shift allegiance and change anything. But if a group wants to move, it's possible to change that, you know, it locally looks. So what happens is, what is looking locally inoptimal winds up being globally optimal. Okay, and so you have to, the part of what is going on here is that if you allowed sets of points to move together, then this would go away. But obviously we don't consider that because, you know, how many sets of points are you considering? Okay, so it's just an idea of how you get stuck once you reach one of the local minimum. Okay. Again, it's related to the same way hill climbing works. If you, those of you who remember the bin conflict algorithms for SAT, you know that if you try to take care of multiple conflicts at a time, you get a bigger neighborhood. Okay. Similarly, if you consider shifting multiple sets of points at a time, you get a bigger neighborhood. And you know, a hill climbing algorithm would never move forward if in the neighborhood around it, it doesn't find anything good. That's better than what it is in right now. Okay? So that's the thing here. And of course, once you have this idea, once you have this problem, then you can always deal with various solutions. And one simple solution is to try multiple starting points for this particular case. Okay? And so you try multiple seeds, starting seeds, and run K-means and see which is the best one that you would reach. Okay? Now, putting that and that together, I'll come back to this in a minute. Putting that and that together, what I want to do is a version of K-means called bisecting K-means, which actually tries to deal with the problem of figuring out what is the K first. Okay, it doesn't need to know what is the K. Okay, however, at the same time, it also realizes that any specific random seeds you pick may not actually lead to the best possible dissimilarity metric for even that particular K. Okay, so here is how this works. This is actually, it turns out, bisecting K means, you know, can be thought of as a sort of a hierarchical clustering algorithm. We'll look at it in a different light in a minute, but it's worth looking at it as an antidote to some of the problems of K-means. Okay, all it does is the following. So think of basically what you're doing is you're trying to decide how to split the clusters. Okay, so what you start with is in the beginning you start with all the points together, and then for each point, for each cluster, you know, you're essentially going to pick one of the leaf clusters, okay, and then decide to split it into two clusters. Decide to split it into two clusters, okay. And the way you split it, of course, is you just use k-means to split the cluster, okay, into two. So it's k-means being used for k equal to two, okay. And then you do to take care of the fact that the random initial seed points will have an effect on how good your split would be. You'd wind up doing multiple seeds and look at the best of the possible splits that you could get. Okay, for each k equal to 2 split, you know how to compare the two, the same k size. For the same value of k, you can split, you can compare the clustering, okay, in terms of the cluster dissimilarity, cumulative cluster dissimilarity, okay, and then you pick the one with the best among those splits, okay. So this, in essence, what this winds up doing is you are essentially starting with a big set of points, okay, and then after the first you may have split it into two parts, okay, and now you're going to pick one of these, okay. So the question, of course, is which leaf cluster would you pick. So in the beginning there is like all data points that got split into C1 and C2. Now you're going to pick one of these and further split. Okay, which would you pick? Which cluster would you pick if you have to pick one of the two clusters? You could pick the one which has the higher dissimilarity metric. Okay, and then pick one, and then you can again split that. Okay, well, advantage of doing this way is that, you know, it does ultimately, the top level one is going k iterations, so you are actually going to have k leaf nodes in the bottom, so there are k clusters still, okay. However, one of the advantages we'll see in a minute is because it's a hierarchical clustering, if you really want only two clusters, this is the two best clusters. If you want three clusters, this is the best three clusters. If you want four clusters, let's say maybe, you know, you would have split one of these two again, so those would be the best four clusters and so on. So for any k value, you know what's the best cluster there, you know, in one fell swoop. Okay, so it's a useful algorithm which seems to essentially, which obviously is costlier because you are running k means multiple times for k equal to 2, okay, but you're doing it, you're repeatedly splitting the cluster. Yes, sir. No, not sorry. No. Any of the leaf, pick a leaf cluster to pick.
If I want to find a best three cluster.
That's a tricky point because you need to consider the size of the cluster as well as the dissimilarity metric. So you have to look at some sort of a normalized dissimilarity of the cluster. Okay? But the advantage is that in a way, between 0 to k, you know all possible clusterings of this data. Heuristically speaking, if you want three clusters, you have a three cluster. If you have five clusters, you have five clusters. Now, this idea, of course, of fine, you know, not having to make up your mind as to how many clusters there should be, is really an advantage of hierarchical clustering method. This is a kind of a hierarchical clustering method where you started with all the points, split them into subparts. We'll look at a different hierarchical clustering method in a while, where it starts with all the points in the bottom and starts combining the closest points together, and then combines closest clusters together to make bigger clusters. Ultimately, this and this, both of them will come up with a hierarchy of clusters. Okay, this one is called agglomerative in the sense it's putting clusters together to make big clusters, and this is a partitioning, a divisive, which starts with a big cluster and splits it down. Okay, I mentioned this here because in this case it also has a nice connection to k-means. You're computing k-means multiple times, okay, splitting the different clusters. Okay. And then another problem with the k-means is that it essentially tries to include every point in the clustering. So if there are outliers, okay, then it's going to wind up. So for example, if I have a scenario where Okay, that's my point. And I'm looking for two clusters. Clearly, what would have been best is to say this is an outlier and just cluster these. By keeping that around, obviously the clustering is going to change, right? Because it's going to change the centroid. Okay, so there are two ways of dealing with this notion of outlier. One is, before you even start clustering, try to identify outliers and remove them. Okay, and that's a costly thing. So basically an outlier is one where in its epsilon neighborhood there are no other points. In a reasonable neighborhood of that point, there are no other points, in which case it's an outlier. Okay, efficiently identifying outliers could be very costly. But there are techniques, actually R trees in databases, which will give you neighborhoods of points, and using that you can essentially decide which are outliers. Okay, but another idea is to do k means, except the part of k means that's actually a problem, is taking the mean. Okay, you know that means are affected by the outliers. This is why in US we talk about, I mean in any country you talk about not average incomes but the median household income, because Bill Gates is there and he would change the average household income significantly because he has gazillion billion dollars. Okay, so by doing median you don't care about the outlier. Okay, so there is an idea called k-medoid clustering. Okay, so in essence, instead of computing centroids, you compute medoids. You know, medoid is basically for the high dimensions what median is for single dimension. Okay, now the problem is it's going to be costly. Why is it costly? Yes, finding a median is harder than finding mean, right? To find the median, you essentially are doing sorting. Okay, whereas finding the mean is cheaper. You just add them all up. Okay, so although k-medoid clustering, in the medoid clustering is a possibility, it isn't really used that much. It's an idea that you can have in the back of your head, but it's not used all that much. Okay, there are two options, of course. That is one, and the other is to try to remove the outliers before you even start clustering. Okay, and to do that, you essentially have to consider the neighborhood of all the points. Okay, and say, you know, if you know, I would consider anything to be an outlier if within a d distance, within a d neighborhood, it has less than epsilon points. Okay, where you increase the d, that basically you're saying that even in this large distance there is nobody. You increase the, you reduce the epsilon, you're talking about what is the maximum number of points that can be near you while you still can be considered an outlier. Okay, and you know, I think I missed the, I mean I probably hit that slide or removed it, but there is this idea called R trees. Anything which actually, to do this essentially you need neighborhood queries. And there are efficient data structures for supporting neighborhood queries like such as R-trees that could be used for this purpose. Okay, now if you do like a longer course on clustering, you would actually talk about a clustering algorithm which uses this kind of idea to first remove the outliers and then run k-means. Okay, so you know where it all started from and what are the limitations you're trying to remove to actually get better clustering algorithms. Okay, and there are other problems with k-means clustering, because it's taking means and it's taking distances, is it assumes clusters are spherical in some vector space, and it's also sensitive to coordinate changes and weighting, etc. Right, if you share the thing, the same point, then the clusters would be different. Even though you think that, you know, you may think that should not be the case. Clusters should not depend on, you know, if you did some transformations to the point, the underlying cluster should not change. okay. But obviously, ultimately, we are computing clusters in terms of geometric distances between points, you know, and so if you change the distances, the clusters will change. Okay. Now, in terms of the time complexity, it's actually one good thing about k-means algorithm is it's linear in the number of points, and it's also linear in the number of iterations needed to for the k-means to converge. Okay, which the number of iterations needed depends on the original coordinates you start with. Right, if you start with coordinates that are closer to the eventual centroids, you can reduce the number of iterations. Okay, this brings us to a different point, which is it would have been nice if we knew what are the good centroids to begin with. You know, because different centroids, different initial centroids seem to lead to different local minima. We tried basically one idea we tried till now is just pick whole bunch of them and, you know, try all of them and look for which is the best. Okay. Another idea is the following, which is basically suppose you have n points. Suppose you have n points. Okay. Take a sampling of these points, a representative sampling of these points. Cluster them. Find the centroids of those clusters. Use those as the beginning centroids for the original k-means clustering. Do you understand what I'm saying? So suppose I want two clusters, okay? I don't quite know which should be the two centroids. Okay. So there are billion points. I sample, let's say, 10,000 points. I have to sample it well. Okay, I sample 10,000 points, run k-means on that, or run anything on that, it turns out. Okay, and we will actually look at a version of this in a minute. Okay, in fact, one thing that I'm mentioning here is that we're going to be talking about an algorithm called hierarchical agglomerative clustering, which has, unlike k-means, whose complexity depends on the number of iterations, which can change based on the initial centroids. Okay, this is always n squared. If n is the number of points, it will always be n squared. Okay, it's a deterministic clustering algorithm. Now, if you know this, you can do the following thing. If you want to cluster, a billion points into two clusters, and you don't know what should be the right centroids, you take square root n of these points, sample them, square root n of these points. The reason for square root n is square root n squared is n, right? You take square root n of these points, you know, by sampling, run hack on it, okay? Using that, you figure out what are the best top two clusters will be, the centroids of the top two clusters would be the two best centroids. Use them as the centroids for your k-means. Notice that those centroids may not even correspond to any of the existing points. And this is okay. In k-means, you don't really need to start with centroids be any of the existing points. Because anyway, even if you did, after one iteration, centroids don't correspond to any existing points. Don't have to. Okay? And if you do that, and you can do this as soon as I explain what hierarchical agglomerative clustering is, which I'll do in a few minutes. And then you have this new approach which uses hack to pick the seeds which will then be run, which will then be used to run the k-means clustering. And that's called another algorithm, buckshot algorithm. I'll mention that. You know, the reason I'm mentioning, in fact, the main ideas to take out of this class is that there is k-means type of clustering approaches, and there are hierarchical clustering approaches. Both of them have limitations, and a large amount of clustering literature is in trying to deal with these limitations. Okay. Okay. So this is basically this is what I was saying. Starting centroids change which local minima you go to, so you can use heuristics to pick good seeds. Or you can run k-means multiple times with multiple random seeds. Now, you know, heuristics to pick good seed, one heuristic would be to take a sample, cluster it, take the centroids and then use them to, you know, cluster the overall set. Okay. One other cute thing which actually you can do without thinking is, you know, even though k-means algorithm is made to sound as if it goes one iteration after another iteration. Okay. So first you pick the centroids. Everybody must then decide which centroid they are closest to. And then after everybody decides what the clusters are, then you recompute the centroids. Okay. Now take the classroom analogy that I gave you last time. So there are two guys, you know, here is one guy, here is one guy who are going to make two teams for this class. The first kid who is trying to pick the teams will look at which of them is their good friend and then they'll join that. Okay. By about the 10th kid, the 10th kid actually is not only looking at the leaders but are also looking at who is in what cluster. So they actually don't have to go with the leader, whoever was the original leader, as the main centroid. They can just recompute the centroid at that point of time. And if you do that, then you essentially reduce the number of iterations. Where did you think of this kind of an idea, something very similar? What? Yes, exactly. Basically, all of these are asynchronous updates rather than synchronous updates. Okay, and even before page rank, for those of you who did Markov deletion processes, value iteration can have asynchronous updates. It works fine. In fact, it improves the convergence speed. Okay, now what are you giving up? You're giving, basically, every time you recompute a centroid, you are adding numbers up and dividing by the number of numbers. That's some work. Okay, and that has to be made up for by faster convergence. Okay, so it's like every so often, rather than after every point, maybe after every 5 points decide their cluster, you do this. Now, of course, it's also a problem that parallelization of the original algorithm is easier. Parallelization of this algorithm is not easier. Right, in the original algorithm, the centers remain and everybody in parallel decides what their clusters are. But this one is essentially taking into account the fact that it's somewhat more sequential. If the entire class just ran towards whoever they like, then there is no time for recompute. Okay, so there is an advantage for parallelization too, right, if you want to use that. Okay. And the last thing, so outlier problem, I mentioned two ideas. One was the R-trees, the other is medoids, you know, using medians rather than means. The last thing, of course, is the fact that k-means assumes hard clusters. Okay, so in fact, this and this together, this is k-means is exhaustive. Everybody should be in a cluster. K-means, okay, and that's the problem. That exhaustiveness is what you're trying to deal with by either removing outliers upfront or using median. Okay. The other one is everybody must be at most one cluster. That too could be a problem. Okay, and so there are ideas like soft k-means, where essentially what you would do is you would, for each point, you would give a vector, which is a membership vector. Okay, which is essentially the probability that this point is in cluster 1, cluster 2, cluster 3, cluster 4. There are 4 clusters. And these are basically pseudo probabilities, so they should all add up to 1. Okay, and it's these probabilities that you take into account in going from one iteration to another iteration. It's the probability vector that you modify. Okay, and if you think of it from that point of view, normal k-means is a special case of soft k-means, where it takes the probability vector and then basically takes the max of it and says that's your cluster. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay. So in a way, normal k-means is in fact the outlier, is in fact the exception. You know, more reasonably, you would want to consider probability vector. And then one of the other things is that it would be better not to do the maxing up front. So maxing means picking whichever is your best cluster up front and, you know, continue using the vector, even if in the end when the clusters are found, every point still has essentially a probability vector which adds up to 1. Okay, and you still need to, at that point, you still don't know what cluster each of these points belong to. If you max then you are better off. Okay, in terms of the cluster quality. Okay. So one way you could do this, you know, the question of course is how do you convert it into some probabilities? Okay, so all you know essentially is that you have a point and, you know, there are C1, C2, C3 are the centroids, and so you can compute the distances for all of them, and essentially you have to convert these distances into probabilities. You could do any one which way. One reasonable thing to do is essentially to convert the distance, you know, by exponentiating it negatively. Okay, that way the distance smaller means this would be a bigger number. Distance bigger means it's a smaller number. Okay, and then, you know, you are essentially getting, these would then be the weights of how close this particular point, what is the probability that this point is in this cluster versus this cluster versus this cluster. And all you will do then is make sure that these numbers add up to 1 by normalizing them. Okay. Now, if this thing starts looking weird, it turns out that the only theoretical justification you can give to k-means clustering turns out to be something called basically, so k-means seems to work. Now, what exactly is it working? I mean, what is it trying to maximize? What is it trying to, and remember that when we are talking about clustering, the most important thing is the external validity measure, which we don't have because we don't know what the clusters are. Okay, so one idea of making sense of clustering algorithms is to consider scenarios where you do know what the clusterings were and prove to yourself that your algorithm would have done the right thing in that case. It's a weird way of making sense of an algorithm. Okay, because normally you will never know what clusters are before actually whatever this algorithm says is going to be what your clusters are. Okay, so what I'm suggesting is one way of seeing whether or not the algorithms are reasonable is to say here is a scenario where is a reasonable scenario as to how the clusters could have been made, and see and then look at each of the steps my clustering algorithm does and make sense of them in that reasonable scenario. Okay, so here is my scenario that I'll give you, which is suppose my points are basically picked from Gaussian G1, sigma mu, sigma 1 mu 1, or mu 1 sigma 1, and there is another Gaussian 2 of mu 2 sigma 2. Unbeknownst to you, I generated my two clusters by essentially picking off points from, generated by this distribution and generated by this distribution. Okay, now of course this is the same single point, so this is here, this is mu 1 and this is mu 2. Okay, and the variance, this is the sigma 2, the variance, and this is sigma 1. Okay, now clearly in this case, I have generated my data by this. So I will get points which I cannot right away tell which cluster they are in. Now suppose I have a point like here. Is it in this cluster? Is it something that was generated by this or generated by this? It turns out that a point here could have been generated more or less by either of them. This one would have been much lower probability. This is higher probability, little higher probability. Whereas a point like this, very low probability that the first Gaussian would have generated it. Much higher probability that the second Gaussian would have generated it. Okay? Now suppose I have taken a problem where, you know, a mixture of Gaussians have actually produced the data. Now, how would I cluster that data? This is model-based, so I actually have a model as to how the cluster was generated. to figure out what the clusters are, all I need to know is figure out mu 1 sigma 1 and mu 2 sigma 2. That's it. That would be the best description of the clusters. How would you compute the mu 1 sigma 1 and mu 2 sigma 2? It turns out that the best way to do that will involve steps that are just a generalization of, that are basically the steps that I'm suggesting here, and which will be generalization of the steps in the normal k-means. So basically you would start with the original points and try to compute the, you know, so, and upfront you would assume that I have an estimate for mu 1 sigma 1 estimate and mu 2 sigma 2 estimate. These are the estimates, these are not the real values, right? And then assume that that was the original cluster. And then for each point, then I can compute what would have been its probability of being generated by this Gaussian versus this Gaussian, where they are defined by these metrics, sigma 1 and mu 1. Okay? Having computed what you would have gotten at that point are two probabilities for each of the points, sort of like what was going on here. Then you recompute the estimates mu 1 sigma 1 and mu 2 sigma 2. Now notice that in k-means you only recompute the means, not the variances. But this is a more general idea. And the recomputation would essentially be very similar to the way k-means recomputes the means. So if a point can be fractionally present in different clusters, it will provide fractional contribution to the computation of the means of each of those clusters. Okay? And that way of doing it, you know, the way of, you know, taking the current points to figure out what are the, taking the current estimate of means and variances and finding out what is the membership of each of the points, and then turning around and saying, if this is the membership, what must be the means and variances? And turning around and doing this all over again until you stop. This looks like getting something out of nowhere, right? It's like a loopy reasoning. Okay, that's exactly what k-means was doing. It was starting with means, making clusters, and then recomputing means and remaking clusters. You know, why would this make sense at all? I never really explained why it makes sense other than in geometric sense. It seems to work on an example. It turns out that this kind of an idea works in a large number of scenarios, and the reason can be understood in terms of a general idea called expectation maximization as an EM algorithm. EM is not an algorithm, it's a schema of algorithms. It's a template of generating huge number of these kinds of algorithms. So you can think of, the reason I'm doing all this is that you can think of k-means as a degenerate case of what EM would do if in fact your original clusters were generated by some reasonable probability distribution. It doesn't have to be Gaussian. If you know the model, then essentially you know much fewer parameters for the distribution than all the points together. Any questions on anything I said? Okay. Again, this doesn't explain that k-means is right. It's just saying that under these kinds of scenarios, what it is doing seems to make sense with respect to a better known idea called expectation maximization. But k-means works even when you don't know how the clusters are generated. You have no idea how the clusters are generated, and you can still use it. And it will give whatever it gives. Okay? So what we did here is knowing, so this is called the model-based clustering. What I just did here is model-based clustering. So I don't quite know what the original cluster boundaries are, but I know the model, the probabilistic model by which the original data was generated. And so if I can estimate the parameters of the original distribution, then I have an idea of what the clustering was. But knowing the model is prior knowledge about clusters. Remember I said clustering is considered unsupervised learning. And then I said, well, there is not always unsupervised. Sometimes you may know a little more, for example. Now, what can you know a little more than just the points in front of you? One thing you might know is you might know that, you know, these were generated by, you know, a model where basically a mixture of Gaussian, in which case it's extremely easy to make sense of what the cluster should be. Another idea which we could talk about is instead of knowing the model, I may not know the model, but I know local constraints on the points. I know that certain points can never live together in any single cluster. Or I know that certain points will always live together. Irrespective of what the clustering is, these two guys must link, these two guys must not link. This is a global assumption. It's a prior knowledge. It's a global prior knowledge. Okay? And this is a local prior knowledge on individual pieces. Now, it turns out that you could actually use that in the kind of k-means algorithm. Basically, you would, before you put it into the cluster that you want it to go into, you want to make sure that it's not violating any of the local constraints. So if your closest centroid, if the point P1's closest centroid is C1, but then there is point P2 already sitting in that cluster and it's not supposed to link with P2, then it cannot go into that cluster. So it can go to the next cluster which is closest to it. Okay, this idea, as simplistic as it sounds, in fact, it's been tried only kind of 4 or 5 years back, as far as I could tell. This is basically called semi-supervised clustering algorithms, where you have these extra local constraints. Okay, truly unsupervised, you only know the points. Okay, in fact, what you don't even know is what's the best way to define the points, because you may not even know all the features, the right features to define the points with. And if you don't know the features, you don't know how to define the distance either. Okay? And the other thing, remember that one other point is, if a point is defined in an n-dimensional space, which has been, just because you gave a point n features, n real-valued features, doesn't mean that it's a true n-dimensional point. When was the last time we thought about that? LSI. I could have just made multiple linear combinations of original 3 dimensions. So now this point looks like a million dimensional point. It's not. Okay? But when we are talking about LSI, we also talk about dependencies in general between the axes, both linear and nonlinear dependencies. Now, if there are nonlinear dependencies, then the right way to take them into account would be to define distances not in a linear fashion, but as in a nonlinear fashion. So you might say the distance between these two points is x1 minus x2 square root plus log of y1 by y2. That's the distance. Now, why would that make sense? Because the original coordinates were not actually independent to begin with. They had complex nonlinear dependencies. Okay? And knowing what's the right distance measure for a set of points is again a domain-specific information. You change the distance measure, clustering changes significantly. Okay? So, in fact, there is this whole, just as when I was talking about LSI, I was talking about kernel-based ideas, and there are kernel-based clustering methods, where in essence, they would consider multiple nonlinear distance metrics between points. Okay, because use that to decide what the clustering should be in the bottom level. Okay, that's again, so model-based clustering, knowing what is the distance measure. So this, a smart name for this is knowing the kernel to compare two points. But that's because you know what your domain is and you know that the 15 dimensions of each of the points are bogus. Really what matters is log of the first 3 dimensions and square root of the last 3 dimensions. You just know that. If so, you just give it to it. You give it to your clustering algorithm. K-means is never going to find this. Right? Okay. And then the other thing, of course, right when we are here, I should also mention that the LSI connection, since you mentioned it so much, LSI connection is that if you think mostly the points have linear dependencies, you take the points, do latent semantic indexing, take top k dimensions, ignore the rest, then run k-means on those k dimensions. So use Euclidean distance, but only on these really independent dimensions. If you have nonlinear dependencies, you have to do something like nonlinear LSI. So that means if all the points were on circles, you have to essentially do a nonlinear inverse, and then you can take linear, you know, Euclidean distance, because all your k-means would do is essentially go with Euclidean distances. Okay. And having said all that, now the last part in the last 15 minutes, we'll talk about the hierarchical clustering techniques, which I mentioned one already, which is the bisecting k-means, which basically starts with a big cluster and splits into pieces, pieces, pieces. Okay, that's called divisive clustering. The other one is agglomerative clustering, which is splitting, you know, start from the bottom up and go up and up and up. Okay. These are also called, so for example, in each of, either way, you essentially get something like this. Either bisecting k-means or hack will get a structure like this. Here are the lowest level points, and these two have been clustered into this cluster, this point and these two were clustered together, and so on. Okay? This is also called a dendrogram. And the cute thing about it is, outside of campus, where people actually believe in evolution, theory of evolution, what I meant was outside of campus they do, but inside campus probably they don't. If you believe in evolution, which I hate to say believe, it's a theory, it's a very well established theory, the way the different species have split in the evolutionary tree would look like a dendrogram. Okay, now keep this in mind, because one of the cute things that happens is if you have a bunch of organisms and you're trying to go back in time and figure out what was the evolutionary tree, where did they split? And since biologists didn't live any earlier than the rest of us, they also don't quite know. All they know is the description of these organisms at this point of time in some k-dimensional feature space. So what they would like to do is compute the dendrogram, the one that Darwin God knows. Okay, I mean, basically, if you have been around from the beginning itself, you would know this. You don't have that, so what do biologists do? They look for, you know, people who know how to generate dendrograms. Final answer is a dendrogram, but there are many, many dendrograms on an n-dimensional, an n-point thing. So they'll call any random machine learning person who would say, yeah, I can compute one for you, and they'll give it. And so you get to then try to see whether this could have been a reasonable dendrogram, this could have been a reasonable evolutionary tree. Okay? And this is a case where you are using clustering based on distances which were computed from the description of the organisms, you know, in some k-dimensional feature space, which may or may not have been right, to make sense of what actually happened. Of course, they don't just take it and say, look, you know, the machine learning guy said so, that's why this must be the true reason why this is the evolutionary tree. Once they get one of these dendrograms, then they can try to make sense whether or not this could have, this, whether or not there's a biological, evolutionary, biological reasoning to expect that this is the correct way you would have split. Right, so for example, if for some weird reason you found somewhere at the higher level that, you know, here is the, all the ants and here are all the human beings and they got connected into one little cluster, that is bad, because we know enough saying ants are not as well connected to human beings in the evolutionary tree. Okay, they would lower down. Okay. Anyway, so the question is, how do you make that? I already told you the divisive one, which is the k-means, the bisecting k-means one. What I will tell you is the hierarchical agglomerative clustering, and it's actually very simple. You know, if you do, for example, one-dimensional objects, where basically all of them have just a single feature, then you start by picking pairs of points that are closest to each other. So in fact, what you do is the following. In the first point, you know, the first step is to pick a pair of points where this could be either lower level points or one of them is a cluster and another is a point. Pick a pair of clusters where clusters can be, in special cases, points, and that are the closest among all the pairs out there. Merge them into a new cluster. That's basically what you do until there is only one cluster left. Then there is nothing to merge. Okay. Now the simple idea, you know, one way of thinking about it is somehow that in this particular case, 1 and 2 got merged in the beginning, then 5 and 6 also got merged. Okay. And at this point of time, the cluster for 1 and 2 and the cluster for 5 and 6, and there is a point 7. And you have to decide which of these three should be, which pair of these three should be measured. Okay. Depending on, now to do this, you need to define distance between clusters, which is what we spent a bunch of time last time talking about. You can define cluster distances in multiple ways. You can define cluster distances in terms of the closest two points in each of these clusters, or the farthest two points in each of these clusters, or the group average distance between each of these clusters. And each of them will give a different dendrogram. Okay? So here is an example. This is a familiar example we talked about last time. So you have again 8 points. So the first step combines those two. Second step combines those two. Third, fourth. Now you have no way of it, you know, combining anything unless you know how to combine clusters. Okay? If I assume that that is combined and then that's combined, then what's my distance measure between clusters? Closest one. And then I will get the top one, which is that. If so, that's the single link example where the distance between the clusters is defined in terms of their closest points. Here I can define clusters where, you know, here again the first points were all the same, and now I decide to combine those clusters and those clusters. This would only make sense if you are computing the distance between distances in terms of the farthest pair of points. Now, farthest pair of points in these cluster, in these two clusters, is from here to here, whereas in these two pairs, it's just here. So you would wind up picking those first to merge. Okay, it's a big difference it's going to make as to how you define the cluster distances. Now you can make an argument that depending on the scenario, one is better than the other. One thing you do know is that if you do single link example, then you tend to get chain-shaped clusters. Chain-shaped clusters. Okay. When you do, and in fact, the classic case of chain-shaped clusters is when I give letter grades and the students come and point to me that they really should not be getting a B, they should be getting an A, because can't you see that the lowest A is very close to them? And then I point out to them that, do you realize that you're much closer to the lowest B and also very far from the highest A? And they don't like to hear that because they believe in single link clustering. Okay? This is also the time, this is also the kind of thing we do when we try to cross the red lights. You know, any number of people can cross. If one guy crosses, then you act as if there is like an invisible bond between these cars, and you notice that chains of cars sometimes cross over a yellow light, because they all think, you know, if that guy can do it, then I'm so close to him, I should also be able to do it. Okay. Now, whether or not it's a reasonable thing, so obviously instructors don't think that clustering of points into grades should be done using single link clustering. Students, on the other hand, do think so. Especially students who are very close to the other cluster, right? I mean, they would definitely not say anything if they were the lowest B and very close to the highest C. That's, you know, we'll keep it quiet. Okay. So that's the distance measure. Now, here's the third kind of a distance between points, which is rather than considering single link or multi-link, consider pairwise distances between all pairs of points. Right? Now, that's a more reasonable idea, it would look. Okay. Now, so essentially, in general, it would require n times m similarity computations and averaging them out. One cute thing is that, you know, you've been wondering, you know, why do we care about cosine theta similarity matrix, you know, to decide similarities. It has one advantage. You know, there are other advantages before we talked about maybe, but here is another advantage that it has, which is that the way, if you are actually computing these similarity computations using cosine theta matrix, cosine matrix, then what you're trying to do is this, right? You know, the size of the cluster C1 times the size of the cluster C2, that's going to be on the average because that's the total number of states. And take one from C1, one from C2, and take their cosine similarity, and then add them all up, divided by this big number. It turns out that you can show that that's equivalent to this. Why is this useful? Hugely useful, because pairwise group distance measure is nothing but the distance between the centroids. So a little math goes a long way sometimes. Okay, this is one of those weird scenarios where this particular distance metric has this property. Okay, now one might say, must you use this metric because it has this useful property? That would be like, you know, the drunk searching for his keys under the light. You know the story, right? Where this drunk is searching for the keys under the light, and people ask, "Did what happened?" So I'll ask my keys. Did you lose them under the light? No, I'll ask them somewhere there where there's no light. And here there's light, so I'm searching for it. So that would be basically doing this distance just because it is easier to do. But if it turns out to be the right thing for your domain for whatever reason, especially for text documents, it's a reasonable distance. Everybody else seems to be using it. Then you can use it. And then you get some advantages on the side. Okay? So properties of hierarchical agglomerative clustering, it always creates a complete dendrogram, and it changes based on how the distance between the clusters are defined, over and above how the distance between points are defined, which every clustering algorithm changes anyway. Okay? It is deterministic modulo tie breaking. It will always run the same way, modulo tie breaking, and come up with the same clustering. It runs always in O(n) square time. There is no number of iterations. It basically runs in n square time. Okay? And one advantage of this is you can combine this with k-means, the way I said earlier. It's a buckshot algorithm where if you're trying to do k-means algorithm and you don't know what would be the right centroids, take square root of n points, sample square root n points, if there are a total of n points in the beginning. You know, do the sampling such a way that it's representative. That's a hard thing to do, but suppose you can do it. Okay? Then you run a hack on it, you'll get a little dendrogram like this. And if you want k, look for the part where there are k points. That would be the best k cluster, you know, centroid. And then use them as the centroids for the underlying k-means algorithm. Okay, and this is turned out to be, this is supposed to have better performance than k-means clustering. Okay, now in terms of the text clustering, much of whatever we said, in fact, I only looked at the clustering algorithms that are reasonably relevant to text clustering, and we were, for example, looking at cosine similarity as the distance between text documents, and we noticed that, in fact, it has some advantages. If you use that, you can actually do pairwise distance computation between the group average distance between two clusters winds up being just the distance between the two centroids, which is cute, right? So both hack and k-means have been applied to text in straightforward manner, and there is a link that I have in, you know, I think by I forgot the name, but it's I think some of these Minnesota guys. Let's see, somewhere I mentioned the name. But it's at one of the second links in the clustering readings, which basically compares several of these algorithms: normal k-means clustering, bisecting k-means, buckshot, and the hierarchical agglomerative clustering on some text data where you know the clusters up beforehand because users have told you what the clusters are. And then they compare them both in terms of internal measures and external measures. Because external measures they could do because they knew the clusters correctly. That case. Okay, and in general, basically, I think that particular paper says that k-means is reasonable, and bisecting k-means is particularly good for that data. Okay, and then we talked about applications of clustering in multiple places. So, for example, you know, either during retrieval, during clustering of the results to present. But that's what we talked about last time, and also to provide an automatic hierarchical taxonomy of all the data, all the text documents. Okay, so this is basically what I was saying. So this is Steinbeck et al., and their little study shows that bisecting k-means and k-means seem to do better than agglomerative clustering. But that's because they only considered these four algorithms. The huge number of other algorithms that have been considered. That slide. And I probably will have to not go into it in too much detail. I might say a little bit again next class. But one of the things that other people have tried is consider different kinds of distances between text documents, not based on vector similarity, but based on suffix commonality, okay, or phrase commonality. So there are, you know, you would consider two files to be closer if they have large phrases common to each other. Okay, now obviously you know that if you change the distance measure, everything changes. Even if you use the k-means, if you change the distance measure, everything changes. And there have been different types of suffix tree analysis, for example, are shingle-based distances that have been tried, that have been found to be better. But of course, they're again costlier, because computing that distance would be costlier than just computing cosine similarity matrix. Okay, and then I already mentioned that you could use LSI to take care of some of the dependencies between the original dimensions. And then you could also cluster on any dimensions that you are given for the points, including the link structure of the points. And authorities hubs can actually be thought of as a clustering algorithm. You can discuss that in the blog. Okay, I'll stop here. Next class, we will start talking about recommender systems, recommendation systems, how collaborative filtering, content-based filtering works, and then text classification. Okay, there's still more Raspberry Pis if you want to pick one up.